Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. This week, our subject is going to be Night at the Museum. The film has been out for a while, but we got a couple of interesting interviews I think you'll really enjoy. The VFX supervisor on the film was Jim Rigel, of course, of most recently Lord of the Rings fame, VFX supervisor on those films. Also worked on Star Trek Insurrection, Starship Troopers, and numerous other films. A quite well-known VFX supervisor. The majority of the character animation was done by Rhythm and Hughes, but for a podcast today, we're going to be speaking to people from two other facilities. The second interview on our podcast is going to be Kevin Bailey from The Orphanage, but starting out, Mike Seymour is going to be speaking with Bruce Wollishin, who's from Rainmaker in Vancouver. And for that facility, it was really quite interesting because, as Bruce points out in the interview, it's the first time that they've done fully articulated acting CGI characters. So for them, at least in a feature film, so for them it was a really interesting experience. And again, I think you'll like the interview with him because he has some interesting stories about Dick Van Dyke, who is a big visual effects fan and always has been a visual effects fan. So why don't we go ahead and join the interview now that Mike Seymour had with Bruce Wollishin from Rainmaker.
So Bruce, thanks so much for talking to us, and it's been a little while since we spoke. What's been happening at Rainmaker?
Oh, a great deal of stuff. In the last little while, we've been busy with several feature projects. We've, in the last little while, recently acquired Mainframe Entertainment because we're getting into a lot more animation than we used to do. We definitely have our eyes on feature film animation, and at both, you know, both kind of levels, as far as completely CG-generated projects and incorporating CG with live-action photography.
Yeah, I've always loved the work you guys have done, and especially fell in love with some of the episodic television work you've done over the years. You've done some amazing work in that area.
Well, we're pretty happy with that. I mean, we've been really lucky because of Vancouver becoming such a hotbed, especially for series that are science fiction-based. You know, it opens up to all kinds of work that we're allowed to do. I mean, it runs the gamut from set extensions and digital enhancements to full-blown CG sequences. I mean, the city as a whole has done really well, and Rainmaker has been kind of at the leading edge of that.
So you must have had fun with this new film, Night at the Museum. It's a good time movie.
Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was something very different for us. It was exciting insofar as it was the first time we had done fully articulated CG creatures that had to act, especially in a feature film. It was the first time I'd ever done any work on a comedy, which is very, very different than doing dramatic work. It was just a lot of good fun, a lot of work in a very short time, but I think it all came out pretty good.
And a bit of a killer cast, really, wasn't it? I mean, in addition to, obviously, Ben Stiller, there was a lot of great people in a lot of roles.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, we had Ben, we had Robin Williams, Owen Wilson. I got the greatest kick out of being able to visit with Dick Van Dyke and Mickey Rooney. Like, it was astounding to be on set while we were shooting.
Now, someone's told me that Dick Van Dyke is actually a bit of an amateur visual effects nut. Is that true? Did you come across that?
It's huge. He was so interested in everything we were doing. He was one of these first guys that bought a video toaster way back when. And he was so interested in it. We did, Gentle Giant was up, and we did body scans of all of the principal cast. And he actually got a copy of his scan because he wanted to be able to play with it in Lightwave.
Oh, wow. How cool.
He was good fun.
And it's amazing that, obviously being a bit of a living legend that he is, it's amazing that he still has such a thirst for new things and knowledge and enthusiasm, isn't it? It's really great to see that.
Oh, it was amazing, and he would come on set even when he wasn't shooting that day or way before his call, because he would say things, you know, he said to me that he would either just sit in the hotel room or he could come out and see what we were doing and ask questions. He was so interested in the whole process.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, the stuff they did back in Disney and Mary Poppins days with the animated scenes that came to life really were absolutely groundbreaking in their day and way predated sort of a category for being acknowledged in the way we do in these days, I think.
Well, that's the thing, is that Dick's had the opportunity to watch visual effects grow from their infancy at the highest level, you know, for more than my lifetime.
Yeah, no, I just totally respect, and I respect anyone who obviously doesn't rest on their laurels, but it's just great to see that kind of enthusiasm. And I think that kind of thing comes through in the film as well. He's a good character on screen, not an archetypal evil baddie, but a good guy.
Oh yeah, no, he was great fun. He was great fun.
Now, what sort of devilish characters did you come up with to taunt Ben Stiller's Night Watchman character?
Well, we were involved in four key scenes. The biggest one for us was that we were going to create the jackals that guard the Egyptian Hall. And for us, this was, once again, this was our first foray into fully actualized characters that were going to have to act. It was a big deal for us because not only were we going to do full-on character animation, but we had to animate these characters in such a way that you would believe it, but they're made of stone. And the hardest thing for us was finding just that right balance, you know, believability, I guess, between rigid stone and enough flexibility in the joints to allow for the range of motion that they needed. And that was probably the biggest challenge as far as the post area for us. And I mean, it was something that we started work on and development on during the shoot. I would bring stuff to set that was being done at the shop because the shooting sound stages for the movie were only about a 20-minute drive from our main facility in Vancouver. And I could show, you know, Jim Rigel and Alan Summers what we were doing, and we would take notes on that work and then refine it so that we could show director Sean Levy during the shoot, which was a huge deal because that was probably the most amount of face time I got with any of those people. Because once shooting was over, production and disbanded, all of the main players went back to Los Angeles, and everything else we pretty much did by remote control from Vancouver.
So Jim Rigel is a huge legend. Obviously, his work we know well from Lord of the Rings and many years before that. How did you find working with him? And when you were working remotely, how did you do that? Was it some kind of CineSync, or how did you interface with him?
It was just exactly that. I mean, when we were shooting, we had Jim up here supervising the shoot and Dan DeLue up here from Rhythm and Hues supervising all of the work that they were doing, as, you know, R&H did the lion's share of the work in this movie, if you'll excuse the pun.
And they were good lions, too.
They were. Well, they have a little bit of experience with really good-looking CG lions. But it was really, really good. I mean,
well, you know, Jim, Bruce, I could actually say that there's a theme of Egyptology in unusual situations in your facility's work as well, you know, with Stargate.
Just a little bit. It was pretty funny because when we were on set, you know, I'm working with the fellow that supervised the Lord of the Rings trilogy. I'm working with Dan DeLue, you know, the people that did such a beautiful job on Aslan. And I was thinking to myself, and I'm just little Stargate boy, why am I here?
Oh, rubbish. But, you guys did great work. And it's in the film. But let's get back to that because I want to talk about the stuff. And mm-hmm. And I'm it's tempting to go off at tangents. But the characters that came to life had to both be threatening, but then, of course, you know, on the goodies side, as it were. Was the actual performance of the animation difficult to nail?
It was difficult to find it at the beginning because the way we shot, the production set pieces that were built were beautiful, and they never really appear in the film because I think we're CG just about the whole time. It was difficult to find that threatening feel to them and the weight with the limitations on they were made of stone, but they had to be agile enough to pose a threat. And I think the biggest challenge was that set wasn't big enough for them.
Oh, wow.
The set of the Egyptian Hall, when you look at the relative size of the jackals could have strode across that set in two or three steps. And we had a real challenge in trying to find a way to choreograph the scene to look dangerous enough, yet give Ben and the fellow that played his son Nicky time to move around. Because really, those jackals should have had those guys.
Well, I was going to say, my favorite shot for that was when it's a side shot and they're striking downwards with the trident type things, and it snaps into the ground, and there's a great shot of them running between their legs and going from camera left to camera right. I'm sure you know the shot. Mm-hmm. It was a cracker. So that was a classic example. They had to move quickly, but with mass. They had to be threatening, but obviously miss. How long were you sort of working on a shot like that?
Oh my gosh, that shot that you're talking about, the profile shot, which was kind of the money shot and ended up in one of the trailers, it was the very first shot that we started once we had done all of our R&D, and it was the last shot to get finaled. We were tweaking that right up until delivery almost.
Yeah, and I think it's a nice shot, definitely.
It took so long, once again, because it was a big deal for the film and important for the studio, because the studio, when we shot all of that, that's really the only time you get to see them head to toe.
Right.
You know, the rest of the shots are tight enough that you never actually see the whole creature. And there was a lot of back and forth on that, because the editorial would try things, and we had continuity issues with, well, how come they don't just take one step and grab? We spent a lot of time shooting motion capture. We rolled a lot of balls along the floor, and we had spears ourselves and videotaped ourselves going after these things. And how would you turn? And then trying to imagine how you would do that if you weighed that many tons.
It must make for a good Christmas blooper reel.
Oh my gosh. There's some things I just don't want anybody to see.
So give me the pipeline. What was the tools that the guys were using, or you were using to get these shots done?
What we did is we started off on set. Gentle Giant was on location with us for the shoot, and we did a lot of scanning. So we started with a LiDAR scan of the actual set piece. From that, Dan Mayer built us a really beautiful model in Lightwave, because he's a great sculptor, and he wanted to work that way to start. Once we had done the Lightwave model, that was ported into Maya, because all of our rigging was being done that way. We wanted to use Maya's animation controls. There's a lot of inverse and forward kinematics that had to be addressed, as far as either controlling the way they move by the animators controlling the spear or the animators controlling the character. And that changes throughout several shots. And so Maya was kind of the tool set that was going to give us that kind of control. Once basically we had that nailed and our blend shapes done for corrective shapes, we toyed with building a muscle system for it. But the big fear I had was that this thing was going to end up looking like a man in a rubber suit.
Mm.
And we really didn't want to go there. So we ended up abandoning the muscle plan and basically just adjusting the sculpts for the extreme poses with blend shapes. Hans Heymans, one of our animators, did a tremendous job with his guys as far as sculpting blend shapes that were natural. Randall Rosa, who supervised the animation on all of that, once they had that all nailed, then we rendered in Mental Ray. We rendered, oh my gosh, I forget how many different passes. We basically broke the whole thing down into every conceivable surface and rendered those as entirely separate passes in floating point format, so that compositing could put it together and have the maximum amount of control.
Mm.
There, I was up for a long sense.
No, that was good. And tell me, but you stopped just short of the end there, because what were you actually doing the final comp in, where you were taking those multiple passes and assembling them?
For most of the Jackal stuff, it was composited in Fusion. I used Discrete for a lot of stuff on this show, because I've been in Flame and Inferno guy for years and years, and that's kind of my comfort zone. But because we wanted to go EXR rendering on this stuff to give us all the floating point info, we used Fusion to composite the Jackals.
Yeah, it really is something that we could desperately use, isn't it, to have OpenEXR fully integrated into a Flame pipeline. It would.
That would be the next most spectacular thing they added, since they added splines for masking in the keyer. Like, it would be just huge, because it's a big limitation. I mean, a lot of the, when we were doing the original test work on the show, everything was done in Inferno, and it was because the lead guys were Inferno guys, and I'm an Inferno guy. Matter of fact, a lot of the other work that we did on the show, I shot using Inferno in my head as how we were going to put it together. Like, I made decisions on set based on knowing how I was going to put it together later. We did a sequence in the show in the loading bay where Owen Wilson and Steve Coogan, as these tiny little Doyorama guys, come out and pop the tires on this van so that Dick Van Dyke can't escape with it. And that was all composited by Discrete workstations with guys, because that's the way I designed to have it done.
Let me ask you about that briefly, because one of the things that struck me as being both interesting and unusual is we normally go to great lengths to keep depth of field, to make things look like we can sell them as being miniatures filmed and real in the film. And this is, of course, the exact opposite. You're filming real and making it look like a miniature in the film.
There must have been
quite a lot of work with depth of field to get the right feeling. But by the same token, that bad depth of field, that shallow depth of field also tends to make things look fake. I mean, was it hard to make that, you know, walk that line between narrow depth of field and just making the shot look believable?
Well, it's funny, when we were lucky, because the first stuff I shot was actually all of the Egyptian Hall stuff that we used for the Jackals. And after that was done, I had some time to prepare for shooting on the loading dock before we actually got there. And the set was already there because they used it for other scenes in the movie. And I spent a few days on it with some high-res digital still cameras, taking pictures of little dolls on different lenses in the locations where I knew we were going to have to put people. And the decision that we had made, and I know that Dan DeLue used the same approach when they were working in the Diorama room, when they're actually in their little Diorama sets, is that a lot of the background plates in those scenes are digital plates that we shot. So the only time I would use a motion picture camera is if the shot had to move. And even in that case, there's a push-in shot to Coogan and Wilson walking up to the end of the loading dock before they do this jump. And we had to keyframe the focus on the motion control every 2 or 3 inches because you're working at such a small scale. And that's the thing. That really narrow depth of field does make everything small. But when we shot it, for the most part, it's all digital stills at 4K that are shot at different focal lengths from the same position on the same lens, so that I could do the depth of field in compositing, because we wanted to be able to control that. And there was a great deal of discussion about how narrow the depth of field should be, and tests. And that way you could do multiple depth of fields on the same shot, zip it down to editorial in Los Angeles. They could cut it in, and then Sean and the editor and myself could have these discussions on the phone about if we should narrow it up or if we should make it a little wider. You know, it was a difficult thing to achieve, but by shooting everything in components, you could achieve it later.
I mean, it worked really well, and I think people would really like to know if you could illuminate us. What when you're shooting digital stills and you know they're going to be used in the film as effectively film footage, what camera are you shooting on, and what lenses were you using, and what considerations did you have, or was you just shooting it basically get a clean thing and play with it later?
Well, for the most part, we tried to shoot everything clean. We were really lucky because we knew we were going to do this as digital stills. Dan DeLue and Jim Riegel had been doing that in the Diorama room, and we had been talking about that, and I knew I'd like to use it at least for components, for safety components, when we were doing the loading dock. And Jim said, you know, he would be comfortable to do it the entire shot digitally if we felt we could do it and do it well. And I thought, well, it buys us a bunch of things because it strips out grain issues that we're going to have, especially if we need to resize things. One of the big challenges is on the show was that sometimes we were shooting the green screen before the backgrounds, and other times we were shooting the backgrounds before the green screen. And as much as you can plan around it, because we're doing a comedy, a lot of the creative is inspired because there's a great deal of freedom for the actors, who are all talented comedians, and for the director, who'd never really made an effects movie before. They wanted to be able to have some of that, you know, that spur of the moment kind of thing that you come up with on set when you've got great talent.
Is that what you were referring to earlier when you said that you found shooting comedy different to drama, the room for spontaneity?
Oh my gosh, yes. Like a good example, we were shooting in the Egyptian Hall and Robin Williams comes by as Teddy Roosevelt to the door to tell Ben he's got to figure out a way on his own. It's his moment. They would shoot 2 or 3 takes of the way it was scripted, and then they just keep going and let Robin and Ben have at it. And I tell you, it had us laying on the floor some of the times. They were so funny. And what would happen is all of a sudden takes would get different, or Sean would be rearranging. You could see him rearranging it in his head based on the way these guys were improvising. And you had to be flexible. And the one nice thing that shooting 4K stills on the Canon cameras that we're using, it gave us the flexibility of if we need to move the camera, like I basically covered that whole loading dock. So if we had to, we could do it all again in 3D. Like we shot the heck out of that room. We did the textures. We did a surveyed scan of it. If we had to, we were going to rebuild stuff. We ended up only doing digital extensions of the walls like we'd planned, but we had the insurance coverage in case we were going to have to make wholesale changes.
So let me just finish out that, because there was one thing that struck me when you were talking before. If I was doing that and playing so carefully with the depth of field, I'd be really fussy as to how I did the defocusing, or rather the blurring. Were you using like a rack defocus plugin? How are you actually getting that optical defocus to look optical as opposed to just looking like a blur. That makes sense.
We were, well, I mean, that's the thing, is you can't just do a Gaussian blur because that just looks like what it is. So to get proper defocus, we were using Sparks. We were using GenArt's package that I've been using in one form or another for years and years to get that. And then basically, you know, as with most of the compositing on the show, it's just big batch files that are getting it done. What I did do to make sure that we had reference to see how things should look is that even though we were shooting components in total focus with a nice sharp focus so that we had room to work, I would then, on whatever lens it was I was shooting at the time with the digital still camera, go and defocus at the amount I thought it needed to be. I also had tiny little dolls that were the actual size of the dioramas, and I would put them in my reference photographs, photographing them in focus so that we had digital reference of exactly what the fall off would be.
Yeah, excellent. It's really invaluable, isn't it, when you've got a real life thing to match up to. It gives you something to aim at and nail.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's the thing, is that I think, you know, in compositing as a whole, one of the things that you're trying to do on certain projects is you're trying to mimic exactly what you would get if you could photograph something. And I tell the guys, you know, in just about every job we work on, it's not what you could see, it's what you can photograph.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It is what the lens sees, not what you see even standing beside the lens on set, isn't it?
That's right.
And so from Woe to Go, like, when did you guys start on the project and when did you finish it? How long was Raymaker's involvement?
Oh, my gosh. I started shooting, let me just think now, this is going back a long time, Mike. I started shooting in March.
Right.
And I shot, yep, started shooting, oh, my gosh, now you got me. Started shooting end of February, beginning of March, and we finished principal photography on May the 10th. That much I remember. And then we basically worked on that film right up until our final delivery date, which was the very first week of November.
And what was the sort of shot count in total?
You know what? It's really funny because the shot count on the movie is fairly high. Raymaker's shot count came to, what, 38 different shots across the four scenes.
Right. Well, it's great work, and thank you for taking time to talk to us about it.
Oh, not at all. My pleasure.
And we look forward to seeing what you guys are on next. Can I ask what you're working on next?
You can ask. No, we're just completing work right now on a Will Ferrell film called Blades of Glory that Mark Breakspear is supervising. It's really funny.
Well, I love.
I can't tell you anything about it, but it's when I watch the dailies, it's pretty funny.
Well, I loved his last one, Stranger Than Fiction, so I look forward to seeing that. Again, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, not at all. My pleasure, Mike.
Well, thanks, Bruce, for taking the time to speak with us. And again, really enjoyed the interview. I think it's really obvious how your love for the craft comes through and your excitement for it. I mean, the story's doing the working on a comedy for the first time, working with kind of CGI characters for the first time, as well as dealing with Dick Van Dyke. Those are some fun and enjoyable stories. And like Mike, I've always been a fan of the work you guys have done on Stargate. So again, thanks for taking the time to be part of our podcast this week. As I mentioned in the open, the second part of our podcast is with Kevin Bailey from The Orphanage. Now, The Orphanage was responsible for creating around 20 shots in Night of the Museum, centering around this that 12-foot-tall Easter Island head made of granite. And it was really a quite interesting character and quite challenging to have to effectively animate an inanimate object. They used Autodesk Maya, as well as Mental Ray, and did final compositing and tweaks in Ion's Digital Fusion. So let's go ahead and pick up that interview that Mike Seymour had with Kevin Bailey from The Orphanage.
So Kevin, thanks for joining us. And this must have been a bit of a hoot of a film to work on. Am I allowed to say hoot to an American? Is that not too daggy? Yeah, a good fun film.
Absolutely, yeah. The film was a really, really good time for us to work on just because of the fact that there was a lot of sort of different challenges on the show, stuff that's sort of out of the ordinary, and you know, the main part of it was was creating a talking Easter Island head, which, you know, really, as I'm sure you can imagine, taking an inanimate object, especially something rigid like a rock, and making it look photoreal and believable and speak, and not only speak but also be sort of comic, was definitely a challenge, but a great time at the same time.
Yeah, it wasn't as if you had a lot to deal with in terms of facial expressions, because the rock doesn't change much from its Easter Island kind of traditional look, does it?
No, absolutely not. It's very, very close to some of the Easter Island heads, and they actually had, just to, you know, make things even a little bit more challenging, they had actually built a plaster model on set that showed up in some of the shots that weren't ours, just sort of in the background. So it was very important for us to match the look of that, to make sure that there wasn't a big leap between ours and the real on-set one for the audience. So we definitely had a big set of restrictions to work within, you know, that challenge is definitely part of the fun.
So let me just discuss it in detail if we can, because I was keen to see how you went about it. Firstly, in the film, the head features in some earlier shots before it comes to life, a kind of foreboding shot where Ben is being shown around in his character as a security guard. And were those earlier shots where it wasn't animating but quite featured CG additions from you guys?
No, those were the shots where we actually they shot footage of the plaster head, and those were the shots that we had to match to.
Right, so it was terribly important that yours very accurately lined up with that one, because, as I say, that they really are on screen only a few minutes apart.
Exactly. Yeah, that was definitely one of the crucial things for us. And we had extensive, you know, photographic reference of that that head on set, both in the lighting situation that we were going to be doing our shots in and the lighting situation that they had shot for those shots, because the lighting kind of changes throughout the film. And so Jim and his team did a great job of going through and getting us all the reference photography and high dynamic range images, and the chrome spheres for us to work off of. So it was difficult, but we did have a good foundation to leap from.
So you're referring there to Jim Rigel, the visual effects supervisor on the film?
Yep, that's correct.
So he's had an extraordinary career. It must have been interesting to work with him. Had you worked together before?
No, Jim and I had never worked together previous to the show, and it was certainly great working with him, especially in the early stages of the show as we were getting into doing sort of the initial problem solving of how to make this head work really, really well.
So come to think of it, I'm going to stick my neck out here. Am I right in thinking you're 29, or I got your age wrong?
I'm actually 28.
28, I'm sorry. My apologies. So,
no worries.
So we know that Jim's been a big player in the industry for a long time, especially with the stuff with Lord of the Rings, but going back before that, how did you get to be where you are at the orphanage?
It's definitely an interesting story for me. I actually I started doing computer graphics in high school, actually early in high school, with a friend of mine. His name is Ryan Tudhope, who's also one of the visual effects supervisors here at the orphanage. And we just got into it because, you know, we liked CG, and we saw at that point, I think it was Jurassic Park that was our inspiration, where we saw it and we're just, wow, we have to be able to do this. This looks way too cool. And we got into it just because of the fact that, you know, it looked like a cool thing to do. It was fun. We never even thought of it as a career. You know, throughout school, we're just working on videos and whatnot. And through that, got a job with Microsoft. And through that, you know, got a job with Lucasfilm working on Star Wars Episode I right out of high school, actually, when we were 18. You know, we progressed in that job for a couple of years and met the founders of the orphanage before they founded the company. And they brought us on as the first two employees of the company. So that was about 7 years ago, and we've just kind of been, you know, working our butts off since then, and really trying to become, you know, the best visual effects artists and you know, the best supervisors that we can. So it's definitely it's a pleasure and an honor for me to be able to work with someone like Jim on a project like this, just because, you know, obviously have so much learned from him, but also it's you know, very satisfying to have all the hard work paying off.
Well, let's get back to your Easter Island thing in one moment, but I just wanted to flag a couple of the projects you've done in that time since you joined the orphanage, because you've done Superman Returns and Harry Potter and stuff, and I think you also worked on a bunch of Rodriguez films, haven't you?
Yeah, no, we did a bunch of work on Sin City and Sharkboy and Lava Girl and Spy Kids movies, and so yeah, we've done a ton of work with him and really enjoyed it.
By the way, my kids love those films.
Yeah, no, we do too.
So the thing that makes the Easter Island stuff interesting, I think, beyond just trying to match the exact on-set stuff, are two aspects. One is the cracking, and second is the bubble gum, which is pretty funny. Let's start with the cracking. How'd you crack it, and what tools did you use to do that?
Well, the cracking on the Easter Island head was one of our biggest challenges that we had to overcome on the show. We actually started off thinking that we weren't going to do any cracking. You know, Jim and his crew were thinking, just from a performance standpoint, that the cracking was going to be too distracting. And so we did a bunch of tests with, you know, the rock talking without cracking, but because of just the nature of, you know, the space around his mouth needing to expand and compress, it just looked like a rubber, you know, CG thing. So it became apparent fairly quickly that the talking without the cracking really wasn't going to work. From that point on, we went and we did a bunch of concept art for the look of the cracking and how far we wanted to extend out, how thick we wanted the cracks to be, doing different variations with sort of shifting plates of rock in addition to the cracks, because we really wanted it to strike that sweet spot between just enough cracking to make it believable that it's rock, that it's moving, but not so much as to make the audience go, oh, hey, look, it's a cracking rock. We want to say, you know, hey, it's a funny talking rock. So we did, you know, a bunch of iterations of concept art and of early development, and eventually we settled on a method that was using Maya in combination with animated displacement maps, procedurally animated displacement maps in Mental Ray. And that ended up being our final pipeline for creating those cracks.
And, of course, the other thing was, I guess if it had cracked up too much, you'd have expected to see it disintegrate during the course of the film, and it needed to return to normal each night.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it wasn't a thing where, you know, they wanted, like, little pieces of rocks falling out or dust or anything like that, because that would just be too distracting from the performance. I mean, first and foremost, they, you know, wanted it to be funny. And to that end, we actually took a lot of the reference footage of Brad Garrett, who played the voice of the talking rock head. We took a lot of reference footage of him actually speaking in the lines, and he had this sort of like contorted facial expression going on as he was speaking. So we took a little bit of that, just a subtle bit of that, and implemented it into the facial animation for the rock. So if you look carefully, you know, you can see that there's a subtle amount of this sort of character emotion in there that we would never have been able to really achieve on our own without the reference of Brad Garrett's performance.
So the shaders on that, were you doing an HDR-based shading solution, or were you just feeding the HDR in to work out traditional lighting solutions for Mental Ray?
We actually did the combination. I mean, we took the HDRs that were available from on set, and we constructed the best one that we could out of it, and used that as a base level of fill lighting. Generally, the way that we work with HDRs here is we actually take the high dynamic range image and remove the brightest lights from it. We have sort of the general environment light for the fill and for the bounce light, but then we do the key lighting and any sort of like very hot direct lights with traditional CG lights. I mean, we'll use area lights and things like that. But the overall key lighting for it is still traditional lights. The other thing that we do like to do, just to mimic the look of the thing that was on set as much as possible, is we actually don't use specular on any of our models really here in the facility. We do everything with reflection, true reflection, through Mental Ray. And to that end, you know, in addition to the stuff that's in the HDRs, we'll also build things like reflection cards and bounce cards that will be reflected in the object itself. That way we just end up with, you know, because of the fact that we light and you know, make reflections as you would on set, we end up with, you know, much more realistic results.
Well, that's interesting, because I wouldn't have thought you'd have needed to do that, given the rock is a very, very sort of porous kind of non-specular kind of stuff. Were the spec highlights really playing on the rock?
Yeah, actually, you know, it's funny because we started out with very similar assumptions of, okay, well, you know, this is a sort of a rock thing. But actually, because of the fact that we weren't really emulating rock, we were emulating this plaster thing that was built on set by the prop guys. The plaster rock head actually did have a certain amount of sheen coming off of it. So in the end, because of the fact that we were emulating that and not rock, we had to play up a certain level of spec on the bridge of his nose and on his lips and whatnot. So it was a scenario where we did have to go to that level of detail. The other thing that we actually had to do, which was kind of fun, is as we were doing the lighting, we found that the HDR really wasn't giving us the sort of the discoloration of the bounce light off of the walls and the floor as much as we wanted to. So we actually took reference photography from on set, mapped them to cards that were both behind and below the rock head, and actually had those cards emit light using the final gather in Mental Ray. And that actually, even though they weren't bouncing any real light in our scene, just the images of the wall and the floor emitting light and cause them to act just like bounce light in the scene. So that was kind of another cool trick that we used to get some realistic lighting.
That's fascinating. And look, you mentioned a moment ago that they wanted it funny, and nothing was funnier than seeing an Easter Island rock with bubblegum blowing bubbles. But you actually used a cloth simulation for that, right?
Yeah, we used the SciFlex cloth simulation plugin for Maya to create the bubblegum motion, both when it was stuck on his face and when he was blowing the bubble itself, just to get that sort of like that really subtle rippling going through the bubble as he was blowing, and it ended up, you know, working pretty well, I think.
So you composited those shots in Fusion. Tell me, was it a matter of rotoing, or was there green screen on all the foreground action, like Ben Stiller's action?
It depended on the shot. Jim, when he was on set, was, you know, making the calls as to, depending on the content of the shot, whether or not to actually put, they had a big green drape that they could put over the head, whether or not to put that in there or not. So, it was depending. Usually if Ben Stiller was in front of the rock head, there would be a big green tarp over him. And in the other shots, there was either the plaster head or no head at all, so that we could create our own reflections for the head itself.
Well, were there any other shots? Was it just the Easter Island head that you guys did, that, you know, the 20 shots?
It was just the Easter Island head that we did. So, and, you know, we definitely, we would love to have taken part in some of the other stuff that was in there, but Rhythm and Hughes did such an amazing job with the T-Rex and with the lions and all the other animals in there that they were able to take care of all that stuff on their own.
Well, we really appreciate you taking time to walk us through the process, and we'd like to ask what you're working on now.
Right now I'm working on Pirates of the Caribbean 3, which is another really excellent project to work on. We actually did a bunch of work on Pirates 2. Ryan Tedo supervised that here. We did a bunch of shots with a dress that was being marionetted by Keira Knightley's character. So through that, we've got, you know, a good handful of shots over here on Pirates 3 as well.
Plus the chance to work on any film with Keith Richards in it, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't you just imagine him turning up on the set and them going, oh, you're already in wardrobe. Yeah, no, this is what I wear. Hey,
that is awesome.
Thanks so much for talking to us, man. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's totally my pleasure.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. Once again, The Orphanage and Rainmaker were just two of the companies involved in the visual effects and special effects related part of the film. As Bruce mentioned in his interview, Rhythm and Hughes did the lion's share of the character animation in that, and also involved was Lola visual effects, as well as image engine design for Previz, Gentle Giant Studios, and Cinema Production Services, Inc. for miniatures. Once again, thanks for listening to this FX podcast. If you want to have these downloaded automatically for you every week in iTunes, you can click on the link that we have in the story page. so you don't have to worry about when a new one comes, it'll get downloaded automatically right to your computer. For the co-founders of Effects Guide, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide, LLC.